On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we're battling McCarthyism along with Matt Bomer in Fellow Travellers on Paramount Plus, investigating things that go bump in the night with Apple's spooktacular documentary, The Enfield Poltergeist, and taking a Lenny Henry eye view on the Windrush generation in Three Little Birds on ITV. Plus, Jacob Anderson joins us on the show this week to talk about his fantastic turn as Louis Dupont du Lac in Interview with the Vampire.
Who does he play?
Louis Dupont du Lac.
I love saying that.
I do like saying
Louis
that.
Louis
Dupont du Lac. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, your essential guide to every show that matters, and a podcast that toyed with the idea of changing our title to Pilot TV, colon, Boyd Hilton, dash, The Book of K, but ultimately rejected the idea on account of it being entirely stupid. But we'll get into that a little bit in the news section. Book or no? Kay is indeed among us. Hello, Kay. How are you doing?
Hello, James. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. And Boyd Hilton is currently walking on air because he did a very exciting interview yesterday. Isn't that right, Boyd?
True. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can say, I think, Britt Marling.
Yes.
Co-creator and star of The OA, the greatest TV series ever made.
Yes.
And about their new show, A Murder at the End
of
the World. Her and Zal Batmanglij, her co-creator, coming to Disney Plus early November.
Yeah, and what type of interview was it, Boydie?
It was a two-pronged Zoom interview, including a spoiler special one.
Yes.
Which we're going to have to store up till like Christmas.
I know.
Basically.
But what a Christmas present,
What a Christmas present.
Was it like the best day in your life?
It would have been an even better day if I hadn't have had the stress of the fact that my microphone wasn't working.
Now, crucially, Boydie, why wasn't the microphone working?
Well, I think I dropped it at some point.
Yes. And, user error, we're saying.
Yeah. And so Britt and her publicist couldn't hear me. I didn't know what to do. And at one point I was thinking, and it was a race against the clock because I was hosting the Breeder screening like about 15 minutes after this interview was due to end.
Oh, God.
So I had 40 minutes booked with Britt, and then I had a 50-minute window, and then I had to walk to this Breeders thing that was literally 50 minutes to walk from my flat.
Could not be closer. I'm getting sweaty palms just listening to this.
But the thing I did not account for in this tight schedule was this technical hitch. And to be honest, I dropped the mic like yesterday. So I didn't even...
A mic drop moment.
No, I dropped the mic. I had a mic drop. I accidentally dropped the mic yesterday or whatever. So I didn't even realize that was the problem. I heard a very distorted version of them, their end. And then they couldn't hear me properly. I was thinking, what was going on? So I rebooted my computer. And I was thinking, at one point, I'm going to have to call James Dyer because what he might know
tech
what
support.
the solution is to this hellish nightmare of a fucking Zoom tech problem.
And I'd have said, Boyd, don't drop your microphone.
And you know what? And then in my mind, I said, You know what? You dropped this fucking microphone yesterday. And I thought, I'm just going to unplug the microphone and use the computer's mic. And that worked.
Was that all in the space of a few
minutes?
And
that was literally 10 minutes after the 10-minute delay. So I just had enough time to do the two podcasts with Britt, who was in absolutely fantastic form, I have to say.
I look forward to listening to this echoey, tinny audio that we're going to have to deal with. So thank you for that.
Sorry. I did... Just before I went out to do the Breeders thing, I thought I'm going to have to check that you can hear me at all. Otherwise, you'll be devastated. And you can hear
me. That's the difference between us, because you checked. I wouldn't want to check. Yeah, I can't bear to know.
No, I would have been too stressed out. I would have been too stressed out, because then I would have had to have, like, you know, who used to do, I think Steve Wright did that when he was on Radio 2. He used to do his questions, record his questions separately from the answers. Yeah. So I might have had to do that.
ADR. A little bit of ADR.
You're looking at me like I'm mad. Yeah, but it does happen. So yeah, it was stressful initially, then absolutely brilliant because she was on stupendous form. Remembered that I met her in the, you know, she'll bang on about every other week in that forest in San Francisco when I watched her filming the LA. And
I know.
And I asked her about the O, which I won't spoil it. But I thought it was very exciting.
Some OA chat as well. I look forward to hearing this.
Boyd meets a lot of great people, but he's never really, you know, like he'll tell you about it, but he's never super duper, you know, like he tempers his excitement. The reason why I know he was excited because he instantly messaged the group with Britt Marling is the greatest person in the world.
He did. Mm. He did.
Yeah.
An interview at the end of the world with Boyd Hilton.
Very good.
Very good.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. Well, obviously we've heard who you've been talking to, but what have you been watching, Boyd?
Well, I have been watching a few programs that begin with the letter B. I'll tell you about
Breeders.
That. Yes.
Bosch.
Yes. No, not Bosch. I want to get around to Bosch. I might save Bosch because I like Bosch as well. You're not the only Bosch fan.
I like Bosch as well.
See, this is a revelation to me. I did not know that you were a Bosch fan. That's blown my mind.
Well, but on a another podcast we used to do together. We actually reviewed it then, and he got in touch with us via Twitter saying how he...
Who, Bosch? Yeah. Harry Bosch, the fictional character.
Titus.
Titus Welliver, yes. Welliver, yeah. Who has been on this very podcast.
Yeah. He's so mates with... James is mates with him, practically. You did a Q&A with him, didn't you?
I may or may not have his phone number.
Your phone number?
Yeah. Oh, stalker,
him?
Yeah.
Stalk. Yeah.
God, this is Arnie all over again.
Yeah, so it's a rare moment where we all like the same thing.
Yes. And yet we didn't review it.
No. I mean, there you go.
Honestly.
So, not Bosch, but Bodies, I've watched more episodes of, and it's
Lucky
really,
Devil.
Really good. Mm. It's a bit OA-ish, actually, in terms of its themes, like technology becomes a theme, people in different, seemingly in different times, you're not exactly sure how, why, what's going on. But so, yeah, it did remind me of that, because I was obviously, that was up on most of my mind because of the Britt Marling interview. But I'm really enjoying it.
How many eps have you watched?
I've watched four now.
Out of six?
Six, I think. Six.
The Empire of You was very 3 stars.
Oh. What?
Really?
John Nugent, for I'm going to out him here, said it had a little bit of the budget BBC-ness about it.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was
that's unfair.
Deeply
that's
unfair.
I thought I was actually quite impressed with the fact that it quite semi-lavishly has 3-4 different settings, you know, period, different periods, the future one.
Yeah.
So I thought the future setting was quite clever in a way.
I love the way that he mentions this in his reviews, that they delineate the future by everyone having aggressive fringes.
That's like, true.
That's a sign of being in the future.
Yeah, yeah, that's funny. They should have had, of course, aggressive, what are they called? That haircut that the people on Big Brother have got. You know, there's two guys in Brother got mullets. It's a mullet, basically.
Oh,
it's,
yeah,
like a,
yeah.
It's like a postmodernist mullet.
A mullet.
That is the haircut of the moment. Funny enough, which I touched upon.
The mullet is back. Is this a thing?
The mullet is back, which I did touch upon in the Britt Marling interview.
Wow.
God, what a full circle moment.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Is that because Emma Corrin has a mullet in...
Yes. Well, as does Harris Dickinson. So, no, is that a spoiler? No, it's only a spoiler. Harris Dickinson has an interesting haircut, and the story behind that is covered in the interview.
Oh,
how
okay.
amazing is that?
Oh,
anyway.
So,
and other exclusives.
I digress.
You do.
So, watch more of Bodies. I'm enjoying it a lot. Watch all of Breeders for my, because the thing I hosted last night, which was a celebration of the show as much of as a Q&A. It was pretty much mostly cast and crew, the screening I hosted, the Q&A.
I'm surprised James didn't have a front row ticket.
I know.
You should have invited him as your plus one.
I should have just really invited him.
Which meant me and you on the stage discussing the pros and cons of Breeders.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Sadly, Martin Freeman wasn't there because he's filming that show set in Liverpool at the moment. In Liverpool, what's it called?
The Responder.
Yeah. But the others were there, the creator, director.
Was Joanna Bacon there?
Joanna Bacon was there, the funniest woman on TV.
Legend.
Gave her a shout out. Yeah, absolutely.
There's been quite a sort of grassroots upswelling of people demanding that we release the Breeders' cut.
I was going to mention this. So, I was going to make till news.
Oh, I see.
But we might as well. Yeah, people have... Because you made it... You admitted that you'd edited
me. I did.
Me
heavily. Not just you, both of us. The whole fight was cut out. Not anymore. No, alas, it no longer exists.
Well, that's what they say.
Yeah,
but that's
what
Zack thingy Zack Snyder said about...
That's true. That's true. So, what... I mean, maybe I'm sitting on it. Maybe I'm just... For a rainy day, I've got that.
Is that what's in your back pocket?
Yeah, I'm going to blackmail Boydie with his off the deep end Breeders episode.
Off the deep end, that was it. Yeah. Oh my God, you absolute twat. I would really like to hear, actually, because I would quite like to know how far off the deep end I actually really to go.
I would like to listen to it because I would like to be the judge.
Yeah.
Don't make him angry, Kay. You wouldn't like him when he's angry.
Oh, God.
I'm going to be really honest, right? For all his flaws, Boydie's flaws,
thanks,
which there aren't a lot. I can't
nice
imagine.
To add.
I can't imagine him going off the deep end, but I could imagine possibly you going off the deep end.
Ooh.
Character assassination.
I said this like the other week. I think I saw it as just a vigorous and heated. It was heated.
A
it was
vigorous discussion
debate. But I didn't think that either of us were that. Went over the top. I said that before.
I think it was fun. I mean, the bit when you put me in a headlock and started punching me repeatedly in the face, I said it was maybe a step too far. But up until that point, you're absolutely right.
To be fair, if we sold tickets for that, we'd sell more than a live show.
Yeah, and that's the next. That's
a punch pilot, up between Boyd
pilot 300.
And James.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do that.
Elon Musk versus Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
This is like Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
We could do like celebrity boxing like Ricky Gervais did with Grant Bovey, which I went to a Louis Theroux. This is the other thing I was going to mention. Louis Theroux's launch this week of his new series of interviews to the BBC, and he brought up Grant Bovey, Ricky Gervais thing, which I hadn't thought about for years. Mm. And I went to it.
Who won?
Ricky won. Yeah. Because he was talking about how, you know, like Ricky was a big guy, but Grant Bovey was more of a wiry, taller figure, but Ricky, you know, beat it. The Breeders screening was excellent with Daisy Haggard, who's one of the greatest people, or, you know, in there, up there with Britt Marling, to be honest, is one of the greatest people on the planet, I think.
Oh,
she's fantastic.
God.
Yeah. She was on Brilliant Form. The co-creators, Chris Ellison and Simon Blackwell, very interesting. So that was fun. Yes. But I watched the whole thing, is what I'm saying, of Breeders. And it is excellent. This, I think this is the best series of four.
Does it go out with a bang?
It goes out with a bang. And what's really interesting is your whole thing about the way they treat the children and Martin Freeman's character's anger issues. It's interesting how they explore very cleverly how it's passed on to his son, Luke, who's now 18 in it. Yeah. And I think you'll find it very interesting.
Yeah. Well, because so that's it. It's, they talk about cycles of abuse, because that is what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think they address that quite cleverly. And it's really, really
smart. We're all just repeating patterns, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So I very much enjoyed the rest of Breeders. I think it's brilliant. And then the other program beginning with B is called Banged Up, which is coming up soon.
Is this like Banged Up Abroad?
It's not
We've
like Banged Up Abroad.
We've discussed this before. You'll remember.
This is the celebrity prison experiment.
Oh, God. Yes.
No, James, it sounds whack.
But I've now watched the first episode.
Is it everything you dreamed it would be?
It's really horrible. It's quite distressing, I have to say. I don't think you're going to be able to take it.
I'm not going to watch it. So yeah, it doesn't really matter.
I know. But
it's a cultural exchange.
We might force you to do it in a cultural exchange, yeah. So it's not on yet. It's only in a couple of weeks on Channel 4. So it's slightly annoying previews. But we're not going to do it as one of our shows, because you'd refuse to. Quite fairly. It's not really in our remit. But it is. I was absolutely shocked and stunned by how harsh it is. So you've got these celebrities, Sid Owen off EastEnders.
Ricky.
Tom Rosenthal, who I know is a friend of mine from Plebs. It comes on my Ask the Podcast quite sometimes. He's a lovely guy. Marcus Luther, who's from Gogglebox, who Kay is a fan of.
Yeah, I like
good
him
guy
a lot.
From Gogglebox.
Mm-hmm. Misha Marcus.
Singer Harvey, as in HRVY. I would call him right wing. He would probably deny that. Peter Hitchens. Tory MP Johnny Mercer. And former MP Neil Parish, who he himself says is the stupid one who watched porn in Parliament, if you remember him.
Oh, my God, yes. Who can
he's in it. But it's... What they do is they use a disused, genuine, real, but recently decommissioned prison. They use real ex-cons, some of whom have only fairly recently served their sentences, and they are self-confessed, some of them, killers, kidnappers, etc. People who were in prison for quite serious crimes and are quite horrible, by the way, and an actual ex-prison warden and ex-prison guards. So it's there's like dozens of them in there. Like, they have to do full strip searches, you know.
Full strip searches.
Yes.
Bend over and grab your ankles.
We're going to see little Ricky. To the point where
Ricky, Sid Owen, says, by the way, he warns them.
I didn't sign up for this.
When the warders say, take your trousers down, he's like, by the way, I don't wear underpants. And they're like, oh, okay.
So
you'd have to take them down anyway, because it's a full strip search. So it is harsh.
Doesn't this have the risk of like just sort of like glorifying and making these criminal celebrities in a way?
I don't think so, because they come across as very horrible people. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's all I can say. Well, you can say.
I said this reminds me a lot of the secret cinema event for Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, really?
Just to be clear, and I may have mentioned this on this podcast before, but the whole point is that they sent a letter around before you went, just telling you, outlining what it would be and warning you that there will be a quote-unquote strip search. So you were supposed
to wear things like
shorts under your clothes, because you were going to be prepared that this was going to happen. Nick Desemlian clearly didn't read any of this.
Oh, my God.
So just rocks up in his normal clothes.
No.
So they confiscate his money, his phone, everything. He is forced to strip down to his boxer shorts.
No.
He's really unhappy. They lock him in a cell with a guy who is furiously masturbating under the covers. Like, obviously pretending, because he's an actor.
Oh, my God. Know,
and then starts, like, saying like what he's going to do to Nick when the guards are out of the way. And Nick basically just, like, freaked out and was like, no,
did
that's it, I'm
playing?
Leaving. And he and his friend just left, because they were just like, this is not fun at all. And to be fair to Nick, it doesn't sound at all like fun, even if you were prepared for it. But imagine not being prepared.
Probably paid like 100 quid for the fucking ticket, unless they got free.
Yeah, I'm sure he got it for free. Oh, yeah. But yes, I don't think he had the most fun.
That is my poor idea of hell.
Oh, yeah. Of same all here. People as well. That's very distressing.
That is insane. Yeah. Well, it is a bit like that. And also, funnily enough, one of the things that most disturbed me about is just casual kind of sexual assault jokes, you know, all the way through. Because obviously the jokes that people always talk about in men's prison, are they going to be sexually assaulted, basically? But and they're constantly, these cons are constantly joking about it, and it's really horrible. So
I'm not watching this.
Neither am I.
Fine. Yeah. Well, anyway, so I did watch
horrific.
It to write my preview. So that's that. So Banged Up, Breeders and Bodies, all begin with B. And the other, my final thing that I watched, which again is going to annoy James, I had to watch all three episodes to write about it, is the Colleen Rooney documentary, The Real Wagatha.
Doesn't begin with
which
B.
Which is on Disney Plus. No, this is begins with C, so.
We've moved on to the next lesson.
Going
through the alphabet.
We're still with B, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Which is fascinating. It's not as good as the Beckham documentary.
That does begin with B.
It does begin with a B. The Beckham documentary, I think, was an exemplary piece of documentary making. So it's an amazing story, and to see it all told from her point of view is fascinating. And there are some really interesting insights into her marriage with Wayne, who I think is a bit of a doofus. And but it's a bit. It feels a bit overlooked. There's only three episodes, but I think the middle episode where it kind of recounts in excruciating detail how she planned this whole Agatha Christie, how she planned to deduce that it was definitely her once she suspected it was Rebecca Vardy's account who was doing it, how she kind of, you know, did dry runs and did like, tried to work out who to send the messages to and all that. It just gets a bit bogged down in
the minutiae. It feels like it should be a one-off.
Well, I think that the third episode is back, which deals with the trial itself, is really entertaining and interesting. But it's just the second episode sags a little bit. So, yeah, as a piece of pop culture, it is kind of unmissable in that way.
Never going to
watch
it.
Except you, unless you're James Dyer.
Yeah.
In which case, you will absolutely miss it. And I went to the screening of that BAFTA with a Q&A afterwards at that. And that was, you know, just fascinating to see her kind of grappling with this extraordinary story.
Okay. Have you watched anything beginning with the letter B?
No, I have not. And I've only really watched one, because we did a lot for Plus, didn't we? So I was watching The Wire and stuff like that.
You did watch The Wire. Yes, Kay was introduced to The Wire on Pilot Plus.
Spoiler.
I was forced to watch Big Brother. Less said about that, the better.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed The Wire, and I enjoyed James's displeasure at watching Big Brother. So I only had time really to get into one thing, which was A Perfect Story on Netflix. I doubt either of you have seen it. It's a Spanish rom-com, limited series, 5 eps, and it's basically about a runaway bride who becomes friends with a newly single waiter and who's pining for his ex, and they both vow to help each other get back with it, you know, rekindle their relationships. It is funny. It's sweet. I mean, the leads have great chemistry. I was very much into this.
Did you just stumble upon it on Netflix?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, actually, my friend Isabel told me, she's like, oh my God, you're going to love this.
Word of mouth. Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, interesting. Is it new? Is it brand new? Or was it just...
I think it's probably a month old, but still worth checking out.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
A Perfect Story on Netflix.
El Story Perfecto.
I was going to say, what is it in Spanish?
Yeah.
Casa
de Papel.
No, it's not that. I can't remember that.
Okay.
Okay, I have watched a catastrophic amount of TV.
Oh, wow.
Oh, go on.
Like an almost obscene amount of TV. So first of all, I finished the morning show. So I watched so I climbed a mountain on the weekend. I went up a Welsh mountain.
Oh, yeah.
And while up the Welsh mountain, or rather while staying at the Airbnb at the base of the Welsh mountain, which was weirdly in the middle of a slate quarry, but that's a whole other conversation.
Very Doctor Who.
It was a really weird kind of like, it was like a farmhouse. I stayed in with a couple of friends and it was in a slate quarry and you had to drive up the quarry and it was like a 10-minute drive to get to the farmhouse. Oh, and it was God. Just so all you could see was just grey slate everywhere. It was like an alien landscape. And from there, we did a hike up a mountain. But anyway, while I was there, I watched the rest of the morning show. And it has to be said, it was a really good season of the morning show. As we said, season two was terrible.
Yeah.
But it really was a return to form. John Hamm was great in this. Absolutely great. Really, really enjoyed it. Some interesting twists and turns towards the end there.
Yeah.
But yeah, good, good. In fact, we've got about, what, 3 episodes left as it airs live on Apple TV Plus?
I've lost count.
I think so. Okay. But it's good. I think 7 is the last one that's aired as we record.
Mm.
So yeah, morning show. Watch the rest of that. I also finally, in my real-time rewatch of For All Mankind... I have now finished season 2.
Just in time.
The end of season 2 is incredible edge of your seat, nail-biting stuff as well.
Yes.
It does seem that the format of this show is an incredibly kind of slow, deliberate build-up. And then at the end of the season, they go absolute hell for leather berserk. And then it resets for the next season, a really slow and steady build-up, and then goes berserk.
Yeah,
so
true,
now I'm getting into season 3. I have... as we record this, less than a month to finish season 3 before season 4 arrives. So
that's right,
I really do need to pull my finger out.
Hashtag pray for James.
Indeed.
Was that this week? Yeah, it was November 10th is the return.
Yes.
Was that announced this week? I think maybe.
It's a while back.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But I need to get my ass to Mars and I need to watch season 3 before we get into season 4.
No more accents, please.
I need to get
your ass to Mars.
What, I mean, what even?
Do you not know that song? Oh, boydy, boydy, boydy.
Is that a song?
No, it's not a song. Oh. It's 2 weeks. It's from Total Recall.
Oh my God.
No? Get your ass to Mars.
I feel like he's having an episode.
Yeah.
See, I just I don't know my audience. I was on the Empire podcast like that.
Yeah,
that I got
true.
It. But no.
True.
I'm on the wrong show.
Okay.
Anyway, so For All Mankind, loved the end of the second season of that.
Yeah, it's brilliant, yeah.
Justice for Gordo and Tracy. Mm. And the other thing I did was watched all 10 episodes.
Oh, here we go.
Of Bosch Legacy.
Oh, wow.
Which we did not review last week. Although since Kay is apparently a massive Bosch head, we totally should have done.
I enjoy Bosch. I'm probably not as big a fan as
Have you watched all of Bosch and the first season of Bosch Legacy?
No. So I'm not in your league.
Okay.
And that ends that conversation.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, I watched all of Bosch Legacy. I enjoyed it enormously. I don't think it's quite as good as the first season of Bosch Legacy. Like, the way it begins, so the first two episodes of this are very much resolving the cliffhanger and the threads from the previous season. And then it goes on to a book. I think it's called The Crossing. I can't remember the particular Michael Connelly book that this is based on. But the thing with this, and I'd be interested because I've not read this particular Michael Connelly book. It's like the 16th or something Harry Bosch novel, I forget. But he... they obviously have to take some liberties with it because the dynamic has changed here. So it's no longer just Bosch. It's Bosch and Maddie and Hanny Chandler. Like, it's a three-hander. And also Mo, who's his hacker guy, has a lot more to do this season as well. And he's really good as well. So you end up with these kind of four central characters. Bosch probably has more screen time than anyone else, but Maddie has a larger part to play in this as well. And it's gratifying to see her as not just the device they use whenever they need Harry to, you know, be stressed out, like they put Maddie in peril, everyone coming for Maddie. It's like Maddie has her own story, and it's really good. So I enjoyed it a lot.
Is he still in that house on stilts?
He wasn't in the house on stilts on season one of Bosch Legacy because it had been condemned after an earthquake.
Yes.
Spoiler, he's back in the house.
They've rebuilt it.
Yeah, well, they fixed it, or he's fixing up himself. So I was actually very, very excited to see him back in the house. It's great. It's great because it's familiar. Like I say, it's not the strongest Bosch story, this one isn't, but it's still a lot of fun.
It's one story all the way through.
Broadly speaking, so the first two episodes are, like I say, it's tying up the previous season, and then you have this new story, which is about a murder investigation. He's trying to get to the bottom of it. Love a bit of Bosch. I will say, again, the first two episodes of this, which are tying up the things, there's a lot of Bosch cameo action here. In, like, if you think about the regulars from the regular Bosch series who didn't make the transition to Bosch Legacy,
they turn up.
They're fucking all in the first two episodes of this. And, you know, no spoilers, but seeing Jerry Edgar, Jamie Hector, was a delight. So that was wonderful. I will also say, this season of Bosch Legacy marks the final, I believe, screen performance of Lance Reddick.
Oh,
as Chief Irving, newly retired Chief Irving, impacting this. Fucking Bosch, as he says. And he does say the words fucking Bosch, which which is what we want from him.
Yeah.
Indeed. But it was lovely, a bit bittersweet. It was lovely, but also a bit sad to see Lance Reddick return.
Oh yeah, he's very good.
Yeah. So yes, Bosch Legacy, all 10 episodes. Wow. There you go. That's commitment.
Impressive. Yeah, that is commitment.
So that's been my week. Watched quite a lot there.
Well done.
Good.
Yeah.
Right. That's what we've been watching. Let's have a listener question. I have not shared a listener question this week, but I have one.
Here we go.
Funnily enough.
I have one. And this listener question comes from Sally. Sally says.
Hi, Sally.
Hi, Pilot Gang. Ignoring the obvious consequences that this could have for the podcast, if you were given the choice, would you rather A, only be able to watch your three favourite TV shows for the rest of your life, but nothing else, or B, be able to watch all past and future TV shows for the rest of your life, with the strict exception of your three favourite programmes? Sorry for the cruel question. Please come and do a live show in Scotland. We have cake too. It's not all deep fried. Best, Sally.
Road trip. Yeah.
So,
aren't you lot doing an Empire one somewhere?
Like, in Leeds. Yes, we're going to Leeds. Next month, we're going to Leeds.
Crucially, that's not Scotland, though.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, they go on the road and do stuff.
Shall we go on the road?
I mean,
just think how much fun that would be.
Well, no, so we can go wherever we like, because we can take Boyd's private jet and we can go anywhere.
Yeah.
Boyd,
helicopter. Helicopter.
I'm sorry.
Boyd's chopper.
I'll deploy the chopper.
Yeah. Get to the chopper.
No.
That's another one.
Out of control.
Out of control today. Absolutely.
Get your ass to Leeds.
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So what is it again? So three, you either get to watch your three favourite shows in perpetuity.
But nothing else. Or everything except your three favourite shows.
I'm going in the second option.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
yeah. No, but he's going to go the first, obviously.
Are you?
Well, first of all, okay, Kay, what are your three favourite shows? What are the three shows you would not be allowed to watch?
Oh, God.
I mean, you've got to think that clearly. This is the reason why she plumped.
That's why.
No, it's not that. It's because I'm kind of thinking, like, I've got favourites, but then I'm like, yeah, but which ones would I want to watch all the time?
No, that's not the question. What are your three absolute favourite shows which you would now be denied in perpetuity?
This is tricksy. Well, Succession, but it's very stressful.
Succession.
But that to watch over and over again is stressful.
Okay.
Then I'd want to go for a comedy. So maybe actually, I'll put Schitt's Creek in that because I would happily watch that over and over again.
But is that one of your three all time favorite shows, regardless of rewatchability? Is that one of
this
your
is three? This is hard because I don't know why all my favorites have dropped out of my head.
Because you don't strike me as a person who probably
Sex
rewatches
City,
all that much.
No, I like so I like the I'm watching ages of the yeah I do like Sex and City, but I wouldn't say it's my favorite show of all time.
Because for me, it is almost certainly.
The Expanse.
The West Wing.
Oh, yeah.
Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, dear.
Because we're talking favourite. Like, oh, not because The Wire. The Wire is, I still maintain, it's the best TV show.
Yeah,
but it's an absolute favourite.
No, you won't want to see through season two.
The third one's favourite. I mean, The Shield. It might be The Shield. That could possibly be it. It could be The Wire, in fact, despite what I just said. It's kind of hard to say, but that's definitely, you know, where my head is at. The Expanse is definitely one of my favorite shows, but it wouldn't be the top three. So crucially, I would be able to continue rewatching The Expanse. So, you know, that's great.
Yeah.
But so yeah, I would have to sacrifice those shows. I would. I think you made the right choice. I think watching all of the shows, because there are so many, would be the option you choose. But it would kill me not to be able to watch those three shows again.
I'm going to go away and think about what my three shows are, because I can't believe I can't just list them.
Well, Boydie is going to be The OA, Seinfeld, and Frasier?
No, Succession, I'd say.
No, I don't think it
maybe
is.
Success. Do you know what? I actually did a podcast recently where I picked my top 10 favourite TV shows of all time. On it, because I can't remember what I actually picked.
Should be saying on this podcast.
Well, no, but it's a podcast in which they have guests on picking their top 10 TV every week, a different guest every week. So, So, I mean, it changes, but those are in there. Seinfeld, Curb, The Office.
Oh, yeah, The Office.
Succession, for sure. The OA. But I definitely wouldn't pick watching those again because I've already watched all of them again and again and again anyway.
Yeah. You'd so definitely want all the new stuff.
No, you'd want all the new stuff.
But it would be upsetting not to be able to rewatch them.
It would be very upsetting, but I think I'd deal with it.
Because I rewatch The West Wing literally all the time. So it would be would be a big shift for me.
I rewatch Frasier and Curb and Seinfeld constantly as well. Yeah. I mean, which is more normal because they're comedies.
So, yes, that's true. Yeah. But then also it's that itch thing, isn't it? Where sometimes you turn on the TV and you think, I want to do a thing and I want to put on something that doesn't require that much of my
brain. For me, that's like Friends, Modern Family, Veep. I like those.
Sure. Right. And oftentimes it's stuff you've seen before.
Yeah.
Because,
so you don't have to concentrate. You can just have it on.
Yeah, I think there are certain shows where even if you haven't seen them before, you're like, you know what, it's fine. I need that much of my brain to watch this. So all of your reality stuff, for example. But I think that...
into snobby twat zone.
That's where I live, Gay. That is where I live. But the familiarity, I think, helps there. So The West Wing, for me, was very much an exercise show. Oftentimes. So I will sometimes, when I'm working...
What do you mean?
If I'm going to exercise, I'll turn on something like Star Trek or The West Wing or something like that, because...
You have that rigid and exercise regime.
A regime.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. I missed that. Wait, you're saying exercise to TV?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a revelation,
I exercise in front of the TV.
Wait a minute, first of all, you exercise?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, rude. I mean, I didn't go that far.
I didn't mean it like that.
Well, it's too late.
No, because I know James loves walking and stuff like that. And no, you're very trim, slim and trim. Right?
I don't walk in front of the like, I don't do that. Like, that would be weird.
No, but exercising with
Are you on your SJP style, what's it called?
Like a Peloton.
Yeah, Peloton.
I don't have a Peloton. I have a cheap, exercise bike off Amazon, which I do. It's genuinely true. I will sometimes watch TV while pedaling away on my little bike. I do that.
Like big.
Talk us through the...
Like big, yes.
What else? Weights?
Resistance bands. I got some resistance bands.
What?
So a little bit lightweight. So you have, but the bands, they're like stretchy bands.
You getting all twisted.
Yeah, so I get twisted up in resistance bands, but while watching TV shows. This is the thing.
What a revelation.
God, I never knew you were such an
I was doing it this morning, in fact, while watching Three Little Birds.
Blimey.
True story.
This is like a real revelation.
It is a revelation. Yeah. I found my top 10, by the way.
That certainly, that listener who wrote in to say how disrespectful it was that I was painting the ceiling while watching, is probably going to go, Lenny Henry deserves better than you using resistance pads while watching Three Little Birds. Clearly.
Yeah, it's because I don't even know what resistance pads are. They sound like something.
A band. Not resistance pad.
I thought you said pants. I was working out in my resistance pants.
Go on then, Boydie, let's hear it.
Definitely buying him some.
Seinfeld, The Singing Detective was number two, which is one of the greatest TV shows of all time. The Office, The OA, The Leftovers.
So hang on.
Yeah.
Hang on.
Yeah.
The OA, which you routinely trumpet as your favourite show of all time, is in fourth place.
Well, no, I don't.
You are a charlatan and a fraud.
It's the most. It's my favorite of recent times. But no, it moves around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. I use that phrase, my favorite show of all time, slightly, you know, as an offhand way. It's in the top five. I mean, that's pretty good for a show that only was on a couple of years ago.
What else?
The Leftovers, Succession, I'm Alan Partridge. I had a whole which Partridge thing would I choose, but in the end, I went for the classic.
Did you say The Office in there?
Yeah, The Office is number three. Yeah, Happy Valley, Doctor Who, and Queer as Folk. That was my top 10, yeah. Slight spoiler for the, although he does in the notes, that's what I was checking, in the podcast, which is called My Top 10 TV Podcast, he lists it in the notes, so it's not that much of a spoiler.
Okay.
Yeah, hopefully. But that
And also, you lied to him as well, so that's fine.
What did I lie to him about?
About your top 10.
Because the OA should have been number one.
That's right.
Your literal interpretation of what I say.
I take you at your word, Boydie.
Oh, dear. But in answer to the listener question, I'd watch all new stuff.
All right. So I think we're all agreed. We're going to watch new stuff and we're never going to watch our favourite shows again.
And we're going to do Wear Resistance...
Bands.
What was it?
Bands.
Resistance
Not
pants.
Pants.
Resistance pants. While watching the TV.
Resistance pants.
That's the new thing.
That's an image no one needs.
No one needs to see me in my resistance pants. Right, fair enough. If you would like your question, God help you, answered on this podcast, do send them in to us. I'm going to say at James C. Dart on Instagram. But if you want to send it to us at Pilot TV Pod on Twitter, you can do. That is absolutely fine as well.
Can I just... say something. I've just been looking on Twitter while you were talking about your pants. I had to try and zone out somehow.
Fair enough.
And someone has tweeted us, Tom Tom's daddy. Now, is that...
What? Tom's daddy has tweeted us.
Now, is the child called Tom Tom? Was it Tom? He's just repeating it. Anyway, whatever. He has tweeted us, say, I hope Kay Ribeiro has received her money from James.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
That's a handy reminder.
Yeah, boy, you were going to lend me a grand.
A grand.
What's this for?
You were going to lend me a grand.
Because James smugly said, oh, I'll give you a grand if you could name the dog in Due South.
It's a wolf, Kay. It's a
the wolf.
The
wolf, okay. Well, still, Diefenbecker.
Okay, no. No, but anyway, yeah, James can afford it.
Yeah, boy's going to give me a grand. I'll pass it on to you once he gives it to me.
Buy lesser resistant pants and more paying your dues.
Someone actually also wrote in to say that Due South, while it isn't streaming, is available in its entirety on YouTube. So
really?
If you want to watch a bit of Diefenbacher, you can do that.
I bet it's on DVD as well.
DVOD.
Probably. Anywho, it is time now for this week's guest. You will recall me banging on about how much I loved Interview with the Vampire on this very podcast, and frankly, doing it even more so with the 5-star review that I wrote for Empire. So I was very pleased to get to talk to Jacob Anderson this week, who zoomed in from Prague, where he's currently shooting season 2 of the show, to talk about all things vampiric. So here is me and Jacob Anderson.
Hey, Jacob, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I am not too bad.
Can I say... thank you for being so nice about the show.
Oh, not at all. I absolutely loved it, as you might have gathered. It's been a long wait. It has been a long wait. It's been, what, a year, I think, since it aired in the US? I wondered if we'd ever get it.
Yeah, me too. I was asking for people would... I'd have, like, people at home, like my friends and family would be like, whatever happened to... You know when you left us for 6 months, when you moved to New Orleans? What happened with that? I'm like, it's out. You just can't watch it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and it's wild because it was like one of the best reviewed shows of last year in the US. So it was like a massive deal. And over here, everyone's like, I don't know what that is. Never heard of it.
Yeah. Thank you, BBC, for being so accommodating to my family.
And stepping in and dropping it all at once, which I think we all really, really appreciated. Are you in Prague at the moment?
I am, yeah.
So you're shooting season 2. Prague is doubling for Paris, right?
Yes, it is. And a bit of Paris is doubling for Paris.
Nice.
But yeah, Prague's been lovely. It's a beautiful city.
And how have you found shooting season 2? Obviously, in a different place, a different environment, different atmosphere. Has it been quite different to season 1?
Yeah, it's been very different. It's very different. And it's jarring as well, because New Orleans is such a... New Orleans really reminds me of Bristol, where I grew up. I felt very comfortable there immediately, but it's also like, it's such a specific place and it has such a specific, like, I'm not like a spiritual person, but it has like a specific energy. And then to be in Europe has its own kind of energy. And I almost feel like I belong less here than I did in New Orleans. But that's, I think, really helpful because Louis and Claudia are completely out of their depth. And I think that's kind of given it something to be in such an unfamiliar place.
Because it is very much, since it feels like a second chapter, doesn't it? Like it's a very different vibe. He's in a very different place. He's no longer kind of under the thumb of Lestat. Like he's going out on his own with Claudia and kind of discovering what this whole big vampire life is. And I think AMC dropped, I don't know if you saw, like, they dropped a clip from season 2 earlier this week, which was Louis and Armand kind of bonding on what I can only really describe as a vampire night out.
The murder party.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was referred to.
It's a great scene. And actually their dynamic's really interesting because obviously his dynamic with Armand is very different to the dynamic with Lestat. Like, so is Louis, would you say, what kind of headspace is he in when we join him in season 2?
Louis is, I think it's fair to say he's like an absolute mess most of the time. I think what's interesting, because I don't want to give too much away, but I'd like something that I have really, and I think it's on my mind at the moment because it's what I've been doing this week. But like Dubai is something to really look out for this season. And I think as well, when you think about where Dubai ended in season 1, it really charges a lot of the storytelling in this season. But Louis is just absolutely not okay. He's not okay. I can tell you that much.
Murder party or no, he's not having the best time.
Yeah, I think, funnily enough, murder party is one of the moments of happiness. It's one of, meeting Armand is like a little light in the darkness.
I mean, you mentioned the Dubai stuff. I love the Dubai stuff, actually, in season 1. And it's obviously a big shift from the books because Daniel here is much older. Like, he's slightly irascible. He gives absolutely no fucks whatsoever. He regularly calls Louis kind of on what he perceives as his bullshit. And I think that dynamic is just so much fun. But I guess it makes up a really small percentage of the overall runtime. Like, did you get to spend... How much time did you spend with Eric doing that stuff?
I met Eric, like, 3 weeks before we started shooting Dubai. But we did... all of season 1 Dubai, we did the whole thing at the end. So which was really useful in terms of like, I could remember things that I was talking about. Like I could remember what that looked like and how that felt. And that was really helpful. It also just gave me just extra time to learn those huge passages of beautiful language. But yeah, me and Eric just kind of, I remember Roland said something to me really early on that was like, when Louis is talking about his story, when he's recounting his story, that he has to kind of hypnotize himself, that he like falls into these moments where he's there again. And that also that I had to do that to Eric. So there's a bit in the first book as well where it describes Louis as like, Daniel describes Louis as flames in a skull. And like, so I just had those two things in my head. I was like, flames in a skull, hypnotize him. Let's start at the beginning. As long as I have those two things at the very beginning of that interview, then we can just play off each other and see where it goes. I love Eric Bogosian is an absolute sweetheart and an amazing actor. And I like such a great scene partner and a really good listener. And I don't just mean that in like a literal sense. Just mean that, like, I love when you see actors listening, like, rather than speaking, and he's fucking great at that.
Yeah, it's genuinely one of the more genius moves, I think, of this show, is changing that character completely. But it's interesting You say you shot those at the end, because obviously Dubai Louis is very different to New Orleans Louis. And mm-hmm. I kind of wondered, like, because I love that Louis wears lots of different masks in the show. Like, he speaks and behaves really differently when he's around his family, the girls that work for him originally, like when he's human, with the businessman that he kind of deals with. And then at the end, when we see him in Dubai, he's much more alien, far less human than we've seen him. And like, were those different sides to Louis kind of part of the appeal for you going in? And was it quite difficult to nail down the delineation between those?
100%. It was like, it was a big draw to it. Like, how amazing to be able to play somebody over, you know, a century. And like, he, like, finding those things, like finding the things that he has carried with him over time, and then finding the things that he's completely lost, it was challenging, but it was a fun challenge. And I don't really, I think that in season one, at least, I'm not sure how I would, I'm not sure how much like maturity I would have had to put into that if we didn't shoot it all at the end. Because I was getting to know Louis as I was playing him. But yeah, like, I don't really know what else I could really say about that, other than I got to play somebody over a century. And it was, I have rules. I have my Dubai Louis rules now. And it's like, when he's mad, the accent comes back a little bit. When he's this, the thing comes. Because, again, got to be careful. But like, how much of Louis's detachment is real is also a factor. And I kept sort of trying to get answers about that, about what they wanted to do in season two, so that I could, you know, delineate between a truth and a falsehood.
We learn that he's not the most reliable narrator during the course of the first season. But one of the things I love about your portrayal of this character is the physicality of him. Like, when we see him as a human, he has a kind of rolling swagger, this gait to him. And then when we see him, you know, in the modern day, he is so still. There's an economy of movement to everything he does. Like, it's very precise. It's very measured. It's very non-human. And I thought that was just genius.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think code switching was like, soon as I read the pilot, before I'd even auditioned, I was like, this is somebody who is in a perpetual state of code switching. He has to, in order to survive and exist in all these different rooms and with all these different people, he has to adapt himself. He's, which again, tells you a lot about how he presents himself in Dubai. We know at this point that this is somebody that he's a chameleon, sometimes by necessity, sometimes out of, you know, fear, other things. But yeah, that, again, that was such a fun thing. It's something you don't really get to do. And it's also something that you do and nobody really notices. You know? Like, but I was on screen a lot with this show. So I guess I had the privilege of actually being able to do those things in a way that was noticeable. Like, even the reason that Louis speaks how he speaks in Dubai practically is because you'd have passages of narration and then he'd start speaking in the past. So we had to differentiate his voice. And then that became a thing that you were like, but when did that happen? When did that shift happen? Why did it happen? Why has he got this strange kind of neutral accent when he's like New Orleanian, Creole New Orleanian? I get excited thinking about it. It's like, I see what to do it now.
I imagine that you would think, like, you don't get to do an awful lot of that where the dialogue is very minimal and it is very about micro expressions and micro movement. But of course, you did Grey Worm, and that's basically, he's the king of like stoic facial expressions, right? So you had a crash course in this already.
Yeah, it's all micro expressions. And like, I really learned on that show, like, it's the way to stay in a scene would be to really listen to what was happening and to respond to it. And like, I never wanted Grey Worm to be like dead behind the eyes. I never wanted him to just be this kind of like, stone soldier or an ornament. And of course he's going to have feelings about what's happened. But yeah, I had to really learn how to do things with my face and try and tell a story with my face. And now I'm like, a lot of the time I just try and remove lines. I'm like trying to say less so on this one, because the language is so beautiful.
It is. Yeah, I mean, I'm like a huge Anne Rice fan. I read all of her books pretty much when I was at university, so I'm slightly obsessed with it. She obviously didn't live to see this show. I can't help thinking she would have really loved it, though, because it feels true to her original story in the way. And I love Neil Jordan's film for very different reasons, but it's true to her story in a way that that wasn't, because obviously Interview with the Vampire is a love story. And I felt like that was the bit that, for, you know, it came out in the 90s, to be expected. Like, a lot of that got lost in the film. And I love that this show really leans into that. And, you know, and as toxic and problematic as, you know, Lestat can be, you guys are kind of magnetic on screen. Like, what did they, was there a particular, because you must have had chemistry tests with Sam for this. Like, was there a particular scene they got you to run together when you were reading for it?
Yeah, we did. We did a few. We did the two that I remember. I think we did three, but I remember we did the first meeting at the fair play. A most agreeable young man with that one. And then we did the fight outside the incinerator where Louis kind of lays out the differences between he and Lestat in terms of their social standing at that time, which was great because it's like you get this that first spark of the meeting and then you get the domesticity of their relationship. Just like, you know, essentially the argument for me anyway was always like, you didn't take, was Lestat being like, you didn't take out the bins. And Lou being like, well, this is why I didn't take out the bins, because I had to deal with a lot today. And this happened, you know, like it's, I love when this show gets domestic, because it really highlights that sort of the romance part of the gothic romance. Although, like you say, it's not a relationship I would ever want to be in. It's very toxic. It's a very relationship, but they can't stay away from each other.
No, they can't. Although season two obviously gives a slightly different dynamic, because it's another love story, but with Armand, essentially, which is a very different dynamic, right, from what the one that Louis had with Lestat.
Very different, yeah. It's very, very different. And, yeah.
Can't say too much for those. But it will be different from the books anyway, right? Because in the books, he's a 17-year-old boy, so it's a very different dynamic. Yeah.
That's a good point. there are things that anybody that any fan of Anne Rice's writing, and specifically of the Vampire Chronicles, will know who Armand is. And it's still very much a part of this adaptation. He's a very complicated character in a different way to Lestat, but he is complicated. Everybody is a mess. That is Jacob Anderson's take on season two. Everybody is a mess.
How have you been a mess making this? Have you become essentially nocturnal doing this? Because it's all night shoots, right?
No, I mean, season one was all night. It was entirely night. But season two, we've been doing any interior scene, we've been doing during the day, pretty much. Which for me, I don't know if it's just Stockholm syndrome, but it's been really tough. Making this show during the day is hard. It feels wrong. There's something about working at 3 a.m. that makes you feel like a vampire. It makes you feel like it gives you a weird kind of giddy, heightened energy. So if Louis feels really like displaced in season two, you can know that part of that at least is Jacob being like, what is this daytime? Is this
shooting the sunlight just so wrong? I totally get what you mean, because it must feel like at that time of night you do feel kind of disconnected from everything around you. Like, it's weird, everyone else is asleep, you're doing this kind of crazy thing in the middle of the night. So yeah, it does give you that sense of otherness, which is the character. And last question I would ask you, which is slightly disconnected to this, obviously you're not just an actor, you are also a musician, and I just was curious, like, how those two things sit within you. They're both clearly very important parts of your life. Do they scratch different itches for you? Does one or other feel like more a part of you that you're more connected to?
Yeah, they definitely scratch different itches, I think. But this show has been a bit of an exception. Like, I've always played characters that are really far away from me. So acting's like, it's a way to expel a bit of energy. And then writing has been about, like, essentially therapy, like self-therapizing myself. But this show has taken up a bit of that space as well, just in terms of like, I don't know. I always say this, that me and Louis are the same, and we're probably not the same. And it's there's a lot that goes into playing him that it's not just like, I'm not showing up to set and I'm like, it's me. But like, there are things about Louis that are really therapeutic to explore, really cathartic to explore. And it's probably why I haven't written another album. Not to blame. Roland keeps saying to me, like, don't blame me for there not being another Rally Ritchie album. I'm blaming you, Roland. Your fault. he's like a big music, he's an encyclopedia of music knowledge. But yeah, they have very different places in my heart and in my head, and they do different things, but they both are just ways of me getting rid of a bit of energy and basically being functional.
Well, maybe you can blur the lines. I mean, Sam can carry a tune, as we heard in season one. If you're looking for some sort of backing vocals, maybe draft him in.
Sam's a great singer. Yeah. I will not be asking him to do that, but I enjoy his voice.
As did we all. As you said, like it's a really special show. Loving it. I'm hoping we won't have to wait another year for season two. Hopefully they'll have caught up with US by then. Very much looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Thanks, it's Jacob.
Thanks, James.
That was Jacob Anderson. Time now for the news. What news do you have for me? Kay, you look like a person who's very well prepared and has boned up on all the TV news. So why don't you start?
In your face, in your face, James, I've got some news this week.
Damn it.
Yes. Okay, so we had first look picks for season three of Mandy, which I was excited to see because I'm a big fan of Diane Morgan's show. She writes, directs and stars in it. And we've got some new cast joining the series this time round. So we've got Paul Reedy from Motherland, Beverly Callard, the legend from Coronation Street, Nathan Fode, I'm going to say. Is that how you say his name? From Our Flag Means Death, and Robbie G as well from Back Ops. And yeah, I'm excited about that because I love Mandy. In fact, so that Diane Morgan was the one that you showed disrespect to before by painting for Philomena Kunk.
That's right.
The show.
I love Diane Morgan.
Yeah.
Even when I'm painting the ceiling.
You love her even more when you're painting the ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's coming back. Also, there's exciting news because Hannah Waddingham has got her own Christmas special on Apple TV Plus. This is very exciting.
Didn't she have one last year? Am I imagining that?
I think she did.
I didn't know about this. Have they only just announced it?
Yes. So it's called her name, insert her name, which I'm going to be all transparency, listeners. We've re-recorded this bit because I can't say her name, Hannah Waddingham. I'm going to say that. Hannah Waddingham, Home for Christmas, is coming on the 22nd of November and she'll be welcoming special guests and there'll be loads of music numbers, etc. And it's going to be filmed at the London Coliseum. Maybe we should go.
Too late. It's already been. I was invited.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
You little shit. You know we love her.
Yeah, I was invited but couldn't make it.
So you didn't think to tell Boyd and I? We could have gone on a hot date night. So rude. Okay. Well, let's skip past that. We'll have to watch it on TV.
Boyd. I don't know. I wasn't there. I couldn't tell you, but I'm sure it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Whoa.
So are you still going?
Yeah, I've just got one more.
You're doing them all in one go?
I thought, isn't that how we do it?
I don't know. But carry on. Crack on, James.
No, carry on.
Why?
And the last thing is to just say that Channel 4 has revealed the first look images of what they're calling an audacious comedy series, Big Mood, starring Nicola Coughlan and Lydia West. And it's written and created by Camilla Whitehill. It's called Big Mood, as I said, and it's a vivacious and rebellious portrayal of female friendship when infiltrated by the complexities of a serious mental illness. It's going to be a 6-part series.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
That's it. That's my news. It's done.
Now, you will have heard me reference the title of The Walking Dead : Daryl Dixon - The Book of Carol, which is, so we have not had, crucially, we have not had The Walking Dead Daryl Dixon here in the UK. We've also not had The Walking Dead Dead City here in the UK. These are both new Walking Dead spin-offs, which have aired in the US. But the second season of The Walking Dead Daryl Dixon is literally called The Walking Dead Daryl Dixon, The Book of Carol. Try saying that, Kate.
That's ridiculous. That's like Power Book 4, The Book of Carol.
100%. Yeah, it's just like, what is going on with the punctuation here? But yeah, The Walking Dead, colon, Daryl Dixon, dash, The Book of Carol.
Why have
because
they done that?
Carol's back. She's in it. She's going to be in the second season.
The Walking Dead, Daryl Dixon is like a comedy. Yeah. Like, what's the word?
It's like a tongue twister.
Tongue twister, yeah.
The Walking Dead, Daryl Dixon, The Book of Carol.
God.
I have no hope of saying that.
And definitely won't be.
I look forward to reviewing it on this podcast.
Wow.
If it actually gets a UK distributor, and indeed, because you'd think they'd be on Disney Plus, but not necessarily. But when we're going to get it, I do not know. I do not know.
It's a mystery, as Toya once sang.
Yes, indeed.
I met Toya last week, very briefly.
Of course you did. Yeah. Of course you did.
I'm filming for a future TV show.
Oh, yeah. Can you say what it is?
I don't know.
It's quite exciting.
I filmed a little comedy cameo.
Boyd has been flexing his acting muscle.
Oh, have you? Mm-hmm. Now, tell me, what was your process for this and how did it differ from your process as sort of British slob in The Curse?
Oh, yeah. Slob is a harsh
word.
Well,
I know. I'm
just sitting there on a sun lounger.
I mean, you weren't doing a lot. Okay,
British, that was pretty brutal.
British sunbather, British tourist. How should I put it?
Yeah, just tourist.
Well, I think the reason...
question your exercise regime.
I think the reason I said this is because famously Chris Hewitt, Empire's Chris Hewitt, played drunk British slob in Hostel Part 2.
Right, yeah. So, no, I was not a slob. I'm just quaffing a Coca-Cola.
So like British holidaymaker.
Yeah.
He was
slash
just there
alcoholic.
In his espadrille just chilling out.
Alcoholic. Anyway, I played myself in a contribution I made to a comedy series, which is very postmodern anyway. I mean, it's only like, I could probably say what it is, but I don't know I wouldn't ask to keep it secret. But Meet the Richardsons is the show on Dave. And they're doing like a spoof Talking Heads episode.
Uh-huh.
So I just played myself as a...
Boyd is famous for being a Talking Head.
What were you talking about?
About that show.
Ah.
So it's kind of like a self-referential postmodern.
So what you're saying is that you were pictured recording the Pilot TV podcast.
No.
Reviewing that show.
No.
Ooh, that
I was
would be
pictured
a step-
as if there was a Talking Heads special about... my feelings towards the Richardsons, Meet the Richardsons. So that's the conceit of this episode, if you like.
I feel like you should have steered them towards a Pilot TV recording session.
Maybe there's still time. Maybe they're still filming. I'll suggest it. I'll email them.
Oh my God, can you imagine filming this?
Yeah, God, yeah. I did once, there was an episode of The Thick of It once where Richard Bacon was in it and it was like filmed at Five Live. The minister was doing an interview with him at Five Live and I was there for that whole thing, experience. I think I might have even been glimpsed in the background and it was amazing to see them filming.
You've been in so many things now, Gavin and Stacey, The Curse.
Weren't in Bonjour La Classe though, were you?
I was not in Bonjour La Classe, that's
top
true.
Top build,
yeah.
I am.
Yeah. No, you'll always have that. You'll always have Bonjour La Classe. Anyway, back to news. Do you remember last week I was talking about how the BBC was making 800 episodes of Doctor Who available on iPlayer?
Yes.
We talked about this a bit. And we talked about how we should review the first episode, right? And you know, maybe the first episode ever, and maybe the first episode of the Christopher Eccleston period when it was rebooted by Russell T. Davies. It turns out that the first four episodes are not available at all.
What?
Yes, because of a copyright dispute. And the Doctor Who internet world is raging about this thing. There's a massive Barney going on.
Who's
among
not paying
Whovians.
Who? Come on, let's name and shame.
Well, so this is the story. It's Unearthly Child is famously, it was the first storyline. Those first four episodes, starring William Hartnell as the Doctor, were written by a BBC staff writer of the time called Anthony Coburn. His son, Steph Coburn, alleges that the BBC lost the right to use ideas presented in his father's script when he died in 1977, and he's turned down all attempts to license those episodes ever since. So basically, the writer of the original episode, Sun, will not let the BBC put them on iPlayer, and it's fast, and everyone's
that feels
furious
really
with him.
Sad.
Yeah, it is.
But unless
sad.
We don't know what's going on, though.
Well, you know, I mean,
maybe
I don't want to get sued.
Maybe
but...
the Whovians should have a whip round, starting with Boyd.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, you can buy the episodes,
these,
can't
oh
you?
Oh, my God. These references to my wealth are really...
Sorry, I couldn't hear you. All the gold chains were rustling quite loudly.
Exactly.
He's like Mr. T over here.
It's really... It's kind of infuriating because I really want to watch the first series. Look at you two fucking cackling away like... it's devastating. It's a devastating blow. We can't watch... We can't review the first episode of Doctor Who because it won't be on the iPlayer.
That is devastating.
Yeah. Thank you. All the other episodes will be. It was a sarcastic twat.
No, but it seems like it's annoying that it's incomplete.
Yeah.
I mean, the completionist in me, it bugs the hell out of me. That does. Yeah.
But it's very interesting. It opens up the whole world of copyright. What rights you have to get? You have to get the permission of his estate, his son, even though, you know, this guy passed away. And you'd think, you know, like Netflix owns the rights to its shows anyway. That's why they do that. So they can't get into this kind of position where they're prevented from keeping stuff on their library but by copyright disputes with.
But it's fine. It's good to be wise after the event, though. I mean, what can we do now?
What do you mean?
As in, like, yeah, but we didn't know that. I mean, when was this created in the 60s? Yeah, exactly. Like, no one was thinking about it then.
1963, yeah. No one was thinking about it then, clearly. Then, the other story I wanted to mention was, and this is going to, I'm going to preempt this by saying James is going to laugh at this.
Oh, God.
But then he's going to regret it. This is my prediction.
Okay.
So he'll laugh, then he'll regret it.
Then I'll regret it.
Once I point out a certain thing.
All right.
Get ready? Okay. Yeah. So the news that broke today is that the BBC has cancelled Doctors.
Oh.
What's your response? Damn, he's just looking at me blankly.
No, but does he know what it is? The daytime
daytime serial
drama. I don't know what it is.
It's like a soap.
Soap.
23 years.
Right.
Doctors
never heard
has been
of it,
on.
But sure.
It's on every weekday on BBC One in the afternoon.
It's devastating, though, it's been canceled. Good reason.
Yes, because it was a brilliant kind of, it provided a lot of writers and actors a grounding for their profession and gave them, you know, every crew, directors, everything. And it's really sad. Yeah, no, people are up in arms, you know, I've seen writers and all sorts of people complaining. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Eddie Redmayne, Sheridan Smith, Nicholas Holt, all featured in Doctors, you know, back in the day. And it is really, really sad, you know.
It is.
Yeah.
It was the entry point for a lot of writers to get into
entry
TV.
Point, that's the phrase I was looking for. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah. Everyone's
James
up.
Is looking at us blankly, but a lot of your favourite writers...
It's mostly blank.
He's flatlining over there. No heart. He's got no heart.
I mean, it's hard for me to get upset about a thing I literally don't know what it is, so...
Fair enough,
yeah. That's true. Yeah, so that was the big news of the day.
Right, should we put news out of its misery?
Yeah, DNR.
I think we should. Right. Let us move on then to this week's reviews. And we begin with Fellow Travellers. This is based on the novel by Thomas Mallon, and it stars Matt Bomer and Jonathan Bailey in a love story that takes place in the 1950s during the heart of McCarthyism in the US. Boydie, are you, or have you ever, been a member of the Communist Party?
Do you know what? I have to check that. I haven't, but I probably came quite close when I was an annoying student. Yeah, I was a very lefty.
When you were backpacking.
Yeah, I know you weren't expecting a serious answer to that question. It was a joke. But I was a member of some left-wing groups, but not actually the Communist Party. Mm. But the reason you're saying that is because this is set during the McCarthyite period of the 50s. And that is the backdrop of Washington, D.C. in the 50s, although it starts, of course, in the 80s, and then it flashes back, as all dramas do in the peak TV era. But it's the main body of the story is set in the 50s, and it does follow the burgeoning relationship between a character played by Matt Bomer of taking his clothes off regularly fame in Magic Mike.
And why the hell not, frankly?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look like Matt Bomer,
Bomer. He's got resistance.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got resistance pants coming
everything.
Out of his ass. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, I hope they're not coming out.
I mean, that's an uncomfortable way to wear them.
He's definitely got a Peloton and he uses it.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So he is this guy who is an advisor. He's in the political, he's a fictional character. He's in the political world of the 50s, kind of advising right-wing politicians and people like the real-life characters of Joseph McCarthy, became an adjective McCarthyite because he was the one who launched these witch hunts, not just against communists, but against people they considered to be morally questionable, i.e.
deviants,
LGBTQ people, we would call them now, and he is like a fairly ruthless right wing figure who kind of has this secret life where he's having rampant sex with other men. He meets Tim, played by Jonathan Bailey, Johnny Bailey, off of Bridgerton,
dreamboat,
Kay's favourite. Kay thinks he's the most handsome man in Christendom. He's also got resistance pants well. The two of them have an affair, and I have to say, and the drama itself plays out over, I think, 8 episodes. It's quite epic, 7 episodes. It follows their relationship through the 50s, 60s, 70s, right up to the 80s, because they're kind of estranged, and it deals with, you know, in the 80s, it deals with the era of AIDS, etc. But it's kind of like, it's a bit like, having watched a couple of episodes, it feels like they're telling the story of gay men via this relationship, and also it's a kind of a bit of a political thriller at the same time, because it's showing you what McCarthy was like, and Roy Cohn, who was his prosecutor. Roy Cohn is an incredible figure who's dramatized in Angels in America, the classic play and TV series, who's a real life figure who was this unbelievably horrendous, awful, bigoted, right-wing, utter bellend, who was also gay. And so it's in this very interesting, and I think very topical in a way. I mean, I saw a story only yesterday about an American politician who was very vigorously anti-LGBTQ, particularly anti-trans, who was found with pictures of naked people on his computer and stuff. So this is happens all the time. Like these most right wing and judgmental of people often end up being people.
Well, it's overcompensating.
All of that. It deals with a lot of that. So I found it fascinating. But what I would say is, it is raunchy.
It is raunchy as hell.
It is raunchy as hell.
Brilliantly so.
And not only in the ways you might expect. You know, where sex scenes.
Cocks akimbo.
I'm trying to think of a subtle way of putting it.
James is going to be
straight in with cocks akimbo. Yeah. Not only that, the toe sucking.
There's some toe sucking.
Listen, it's very sensual, guys.
I have questions. Sorry?
Sensual scenes.
Yeah, I thought you were saying it's
I must admit, there was a part sensual. Of me that was just like...
No, I'm just saying they like... Yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking...
advocating for
it looked like he'd just been... he'd had a busy day at work and just taken his shoes off. I think you want to have a shower first. I'm like... I was a bit
James.
Like, no! I was quite hung up on that.
I was absolutely thinking the same. I was like...
No,
okay,
we all were.
Because like, the thing is, there's a sort of an obsession with taking socks off, right? Socks appeal. I was like, yeah, okay, fine. Okay, that's going to happen. I can handle that. And then as soon as he started going near that thing, I was like, he has not bathed.
I've got lots of questions, and I think, in fact, I resolved to get Johnny Bailey on the
yes,
podcast
please.
To ask him about all of this, mm-hmm. because obviously I'm sure there's intimacy coordinators and stuff. But when he's reading the script and it says, and then you grab his foot and you stick his foot in your mouth,
you stick most of his foot in your mouth,
in your mouth. What is your reaction? You're like, okay, that's a lot of trust, isn't it?
What's he going to do? Is he going to protest or is he going to toe the line?
Oh,
you've been preparing that. Look how happy he is with that. He's so happy.
He's
toe the line. I mean, it's good. I'll give you that. But it's so fascinating. It's a rare... I think I remember saying this about that scene in The White Lotus, famous scene in The White Lotus.
Oh, yeah.
Where like, it's rare that you get a sex act, a moment of intimacy that you that's out of the norms of what you normally get on TV. And I feel like this is definitely pushed back another boundary of toe-related.
Yeah, but I think it's
foot
brilliant.
Foot-related. No, I'm totally...
Yeah, I think
it's
great.
It's fascinating and clever. But I really want to know what the backstory is
can
of
I
how
just,
they filmed this scene.
Can I
I'm
just
fascinated
tell you something,
by
right?
the whole thing.
So I watched the majority of this at home. And
yes.
Which is totally, you know, I love this. I think it's fantastic for so many different reasons. And then I had to finish watching it in the office, right? And I was watching it as that toe-sucking scene came on.
Yeah.
And that's why a few, like about 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, Boyd looked over to me and he goes, why are you watching that lavish drama a size of a thumbnail?
She had a tiny little box on her.
And I was like, because he's sucking his toe and I had it massive. I had it full screen.
It was just toe sucking. It could have been a lot worse.
Oh. I mean, maybe it'll get more worse. Maybe the foot related sex will get more explicit. Who knows? You know.
Well, listen.
Because that particular scene, I don't think it's like that's not a scene that I would have been coy about if it had been on the train, right? Because it's not particularly, you know,
no,
graphic. It's more suggestive
it's
and
surprising.
Sensual.
No.
And it's just surprising. It's like it's literal foot in mouth syndrome.
No,
like
no. But he moves up.
No, he doesn't stay on his toes. He does progress. That is true.
I'm sorry. Let me. I'm just imagining you on the tube with your laptop and the foot sucking scene. I'm done. You're like, it's perfectly normal.
Hey,
everyone's like,
I've already told
guy?
You about my plane situation playing Immortality when I was having to zoom in on boobs.
Yeah, do you remember
on a
the whole
plane?
Boob chat? Who would you be obsessed for a week about boobs?
Yeah, but even that is like boobs are boobs. This is
a toe.
This is a foot in mouth.
It's a lot of sexy scenes.
Yeah. Anyway, kudos to them for coming up with that. And as I say, I have to find out what the...
It doesn't feel gratuitous. I don't think it does. I think
I'm not criticising. Honestly, I'm totally in favour of it. I think it feels like it definitely feels like they were thought long and hard about how to have a scene that you may not have seen before on TV because we're pushing them out the boundaries. So to me, it did feel like that to me, and I give them credit for it.
I'm trying to think if there's any toe sucking. I've seen anything else. I mean, the front pages of the newspapers, obviously. Fergie was the OG toe sucker.
Dealt with in the Crown. Yeah. Not visually, though. Not fully dramatised. I mean, that probably would have been a bridge too far.
Bridgerton too far
for Netflix. I think there is a film or TV show that's, I'm sure it's not the first, but it just is. It's quite a sudden moment. It's a very effective. It's very clever.
It's an arresting
provocative,
image.
It's arresting. All of those things. And I agree. And I think the show is excellent. I think it's really well done. Those two have a great chemistry together. And I think it's fascinating that Jonathan Bailey's character is a staunch Christian, and Matt Bomer's character is just a staunch kind of ruthless Republican. And to have those, it's rare as it is to see toe sucking on TV. It's also rare to see right wing gay people are like that on TV as well. So this is a fascinating story, very well told. And I'm interested in just how ruthless Matt Bomer's character. He is fucking horrible.
Yeah, he
is. At the same time as, like, he's the kind of, in quotes, hero of the story, but he's really nasty, horrible, and ruthless. Well, and we'll think nothing of double crossing, you know, people in it without wanting to give anything away.
Yeah, that's the thing, because we see him, like, covering his back in quite despicable way.
Horrible. So in all those ways, it's kind of a refreshing, different, new spin on, you know, kind of on an age-old story.
Doesn't pass the Bell-end test.
You didn't like
well, he was a bell-end.
Jonathan Bailey's not.
No, he's great, he's always in a scene with a bell-end. He rarely gets to speak to anyone.
I mean, it's very hard to know what
you're
literally to speaking.
What do you say?
Oh, that's true. I mean,
in many ways, in episode two. Sorry. Literal.
I really enjoy it. I think it's such a beautiful love story, like, beyond, you know.
Well, I would have thought it was more beautiful if one of them wasn't a raging
bell-end.
It's a little bit toxic at times. I think a lot of it is that he, for his own protection, has set up emotional barriers so he doesn't get involved with people, and he behaves like a dick. I think partly out of self-protection rather than because inherently he's a penis. But so I think you do see, and certainly by the end of the first episode, you're starting to see that maybe there is more to him than just this incredibly unpleasant exterior.
Yeah, in fact, you definitely do. There's a whole, you know, like that. I think it's just, I don't know, I found it really sort of heartbreaking and exhilarating at the same time. And I at the end of the first episode, I just found it crushing. Like, I actually got quite teary. It was quite an emotional roller coaster for me, actually. I really, really am invested in this. And so I can't wait to watch the rest of it. And I will commit to watching it, because I've just realised the other day that I start watching stuff for the podcast, and then because we're watching so many different things, I never get to finish anything. Whereas with this, I'm committing. I really want to see how it turns out.
This is a genuine issue. I was actually thinking this the other day, looking through my to watch list, the amount of shows I genuinely love but haven't been able to finish because it's relentless, because I had obviously 10 hours of Bosch to watch. But anyway, Fellow Travellers, which comes to the Paramount Plus. When, Boydie?
Saturday.
On Saturday.
Yes.
Next up, we have the Enfield Poltergeist, which is a curious Apple documentary that blends historical media with modern reenactments. And this tells the story of a supposed haunting that happened in North London back in the 70s, a story that will be very familiar to anyone who happened to watch The Conjuring 2. Kay, as our resident horror buff, not to mention someone who's prone to throw household objects around the room with little to no warning, did you get into the spirit of the Enfield Poltergeist?
No, I didn't. I did not. This is an interesting one. Primarily because when I first, I mean, I'm to be very, like, honest about this, and so this is my issue, not with the show, just my issues, is that I had some technical issues. We pulled the record of this forward. I was running out of time, so I was, like, getting a bit stressed out trying to watch it. And then I was shooting questions at Boyd, and he was getting frustrated that I wasn't just watching it because I was confused, okay? So I started watching this, and I thought it was a drama. And I thought it was in a similar way to The Reckoning, which was about real, you know, obviously real life events, but it was a drama, bookended with first person accounts, etc. I thought it was like that. So, but I was getting really confused because then there was like mention of lip syncing and blah, blah, blah. And then, so I kept on asking, I was like, what is this? And then he explained, he was like, no. And then he finally like acquiesced and told me. And so it's a documentary about, well, exactly what you just said, James, the
Enfield Haunting. It is a famous, so The Conjuring 2 is literally called The Enfield Haunting, and it is the story of this famous incident that happened in, I don't know what year, was it 76? It was in the 70s.
Yeah,
and it was in Enfield in North London, which is very near where I used to live, and which were all the houses, those very sort of clear sort of semis, look, those North London semis look very, very familiar to me. But there were a family, mother, son, two daughters.
Yeah.
And there is some, shall we say, supernatural activity which seems to centralise around the two girls, one of them in particular called Janet. And in The Conjuring 2, obviously it's Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson investigating this. And at the end of that film, over the credits, they play these audio recordings, which are famously, because when they investigated this haunting, they recorded the audio. So what they've done, they've essentially extrapolated the credits from The Conjuring 2 and made a documentary out of it. So you've got all of the audio, which is recorded by the paranormal investigator and the journalist and whatnot. But to give it a little bit of visual interest, they have sort of period-dressed actors from the modern day reenacting the scenes and lip-syncing to the original audio. So you have modern actors in 4K wearing 70s clothes and 70s tashes, I should point out. But they are lip-syncing along to this slightly tinny old audio recordings from the 70s.
It doesn't work for me. It was just too, and then I had this discussion with Boyd, a pre-pod discussion. I know it's illegal, but he was like, no, this happens a lot. And I was like, who thought of this?
As in, haunting.
They're all over the place.
No, lip syncing.
The lip syncing, getting actors to lip sync verbatim recordings is a quite fairly recent phenomenon as far as I know, but it now happens quite a lot. There was a documentary about AIDS on BBC that used it rather brilliantly. There was another documentary about a school in Scotland, I think, that did it as well. So it's become increasingly popular. When I see it, I always think it's an incredible technical achievement to lip sync so brilliantly. And I have to, the actors on this do it brilliantly, I think. That you, if you didn't know, you'd think, oh, that's a bit weird. But it is like this coming out of their mouths.
You
the
think,
timing.
If you didn't know, you'd think, did Boyd drop the microphone? Is that why the audio sounds so terrible?
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you know what? I agree. It is like, it is a real skill and a craft. However, it is weird. And what happens then is then I become fixated on seeing if there's any like mismatch. Do you know what I mean? That's why I'm starting to concentrate on more than the actual what they're saying. So I just, I think either make a documentary or do a dramatization. I'm not into this mashup of genres. I just don't think it works, is my bottom line.
I mean, it's not. It's confusing because it's not really a dramatization. It is using that device. And on top of that device, you get interviews with actual people who were there. So it kind of like, it is a bit confusing, I think, the format of it. And it kind of thrushes, there's little kind of like artistic, arty touches. Like, so they kind of bring in they show you the build of the fake house, don't they?
That's right.
First.
Yeah.
So I think like, it's slightly hung up on itself, I felt. And so I'm kind of agreeing with you. For me, the issue was, I think it was trying to be a bit clever. I don't know. I think this story has been told so many times. So not only in The Conjuring 2, it was the basis for Ghost Watch, the legendary Stephen Falk spoof, kind of spooky drama, which was legendary in 1992. There was a Sky drama series called The Enfield Haunting in 2015. There is a play called The Enfield Haunting, which is just about to start in the West End with Catherine Tate as the main role. And that's kind of literally on about any minute now. So this story has become kind of like iconic, an overused word, but in this case, it actually is appropriate. One of the most famous, probably the most famous alleged hauntings in the world because what does make it of interest to me is you've got more than one person, you've got a group of people who all think they saw stuff that was paranormal. And I think that is, as a complete skeptic, I don't believe in this stuff for one minute. I don't believe in anything otherworldly or supernatural or anything or religious or anything. It's all bullshit as far as I'm concerned. But this does stop you in your tracks because you've got, eloquent people who don't seem to be bonkers, who all kind of seem to be saying that they saw objects moving and people behaving in a way that was absolutely unaccountable, is that the word or whatever? And it is fascinating. So I think that's why it's so famous, but it is quite incredible how many tellings of this story there have been.
Mm. And I would recommend you do not read up on the Enfield Haunting on Wikipedia because it will utterly ruin the show for you. What's interesting about this is Janet, who is the girl who the haunting is based around.
The daughter, is that?
The little girl appears in this documentary. Mm. So she is interviewed in one of the later episodes. And I think really that's the sort of the showstopper is that they bring her in to talk about it. So I think that's interesting. But I know what you mean. Like the format of it, the reenactment thing, it's a little bit jarring for me at times.
Yeah,
exactly.
And and because they obviously you're using a lot of this audio, it's because it's neither one thing nor the other, is it? Because if you're going to do a documentary, you would cut that very specifically in a, to tell a very specific story. If you're doing a dramatization, you would tell it. But this is neither one thing nor the other. So it's slightly rambling and random at times because they're using this great audio because this is the audio that they've got.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're just like, well, I this isn't
at one point
doing much for me.
There was this Graham Morris, a Daily Mirror photographer, who's walking around a reconstructed scene.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, it was so many years ago. This is weird. This is strange.
Yeah.
I thought, yes, it is fucking weird and strange, Graham. What is going on?
He's walking
on?
Around the set that they've created.
Exactly.
And then at the end of the episode, the camera kind of drifts out the window to show you the soundstage that the set is constructed on, obviously.
That's what, yeah.
Yeah, which is, again, a slightly odd conceit, but it's just showing you that this is a fabrication of a 70s house. It's not actually the same. Although they do show you the outsides of, I don't know whether it's the exact address. I'm assuming it probably is, but it's that classic sort of like North London
so
semi.
So if it wasn't, what would be the point? Do you know what I mean? I just, there's a lot of these little quirks and things. I'm like, what is the
I suspect
this,
it
really?
Is the real house, though it does have modern double glazing, so I don't think it's a period shot. I think it's a modern shot. But yeah, it's an interesting story, but ultimately I was left thinking you're better off watching The Conjuring 2.
Wow. And that is a bit of an indictment, I have to say.
Sorry. Yeah. Anyway, this airs on Apple TV Plus. When, Boydie?
Oh, that's a good question. Friday.
On Friday. Finally this week. We have Three Little Birds. This is a Windrush story written by National Treasure, Sir Lenny Henry, and based loosely on his own mother's experience moving to the UK in the late 50s. This is produced by the notorious RTD. We do not have Three Little Birds to discuss this one, but we do have One Little Boyd.
Oh, sweet.
Yes. This is a... It's interesting how Lenny Henry hasn't written that much. You know, I mean, wrote some of his kind of own comedy stuff down the years. And there was a one-off drama based on his family a few years ago on the BBC, which was really good. But this was like a new thing for him in a way, a big kind of... a kind of very important passion project that's also a proper Sunday night period drama on ITV1. And I think it's really good. I think he's done a really good and interesting. He worked with Russell T. Davis on it a lot. Russell T. Davis kind of like helped him with the script, helped him kind of get the shape together and, you know, kind of almost like as an advisory role, I believe. And his, you know, credits, I think his official credits is an exec producer. And Lenny Henry pops up in it as a character one, but he's definitely not the main character. The main characters are these three sisters, and their friend. And the contrast between, they're very well delineated. I think what the reason why I don't want to give Russell Davis all the credit, this is Lenny Henry's work for sure, but I feel like the influence of Russell's there, because in the way that after about 10 minutes of being introduced to these three main characters, you know them pretty well. You're like, oh yeah, I believe in them. You know, one of them's a staunch Christian. They're going over from Jamaica to Britain. They're stopping off in London first. Then they're going to go up to Dudley in the Westminster, which is of course where Lenny Henry grew up. And they're making this journey for one of the women wants to be famous, wants to be like an actress and wants to go into show business. Another one has the Christian one, thinks she's going to meet their brother and he's the good prospective husband for her. And that's kind of her story. And the other woman faces a really tough situation at home with her husband. And it's difficult to know where how spoilery to get about that. But I thought her story was very powerful and quite surprisingly kind of like powerful.
Heart-hitting.
For this going out 8 o'clock, by the way. This is an 8 o'clock Sunday slot. And it's not, you might consider that to be the cozy, you know, that's the cozy crime slot.
Yeah, it was not cozy. It's not quite cozy. Upsetting at times.
It is quite upsetting at times, exactly. So I thought it was really admirable for that. I think it's really good that it's going out pre-Watershed, because I think families will find it fascinating. And it's just, you know, this is going out in Black History Month. I think that's a deliberate move by ITV1. But as Lenny Henry said at the launch of this, which I went to, this is a story that could be told any time and has to be told and has to keep being told, especially at a time, because this Windrush generation, remember, they were pretty much invited over by the British.
You know,
They were encouraged to come. Mm. And then as soon as they arrive, they're subjected to racism and horrendous treatment. And you've got, you know, the signs up in pubs, which no Irish, no blacks, no dogs, which really were. I remember seeing those signs like when I was a kid. You know,
really?
Absolutely. Yeah, they were still around until fairly recently.
Wait, are you a vampire?
No, I'm not a vampire. Okay. I'm just old. I'm very, very old. I remember seeing those. So it does not... It does that really good thing, which I think the best TV drama does, best kind of like big mainstream TV drama, which is that it smuggles in a lot of issues and topics And kind of a lot of the anger within, you know, Lenny Henry at the way his relatives are treated within a very accessible, instantly kind of enjoyable, quite funny sometimes story. So you get the racism, the way they're treated. You get the police being absolute fucking racist bastards, basically. And there's more of that in episode two. There's like a police raid thing that goes on and more involvement with the police who were completely institutionally racist and probably still are, in fact. So it kind of, and the domestic situation of that character, and it kind of, it incorporates all of this stuff into a very, very interesting, entertaining show. So I think it's really good. I think
it strikes that balance, doesn't it, of being entertaining, yet it is very, it's a sobering watch. Mm. And I think it's an important watch because actually some of this stuff I wasn't, obviously you knew a lot of the elements of this, but to see it play out and see
how. It makes a difference, doesn't it?
It really does.
Different to reading broad strokes about what Windrush was.
And I think, because you're right, because you become so invested in these three characters and their stories, you really feel their pain. You know, they've come over for this better life in the UK. This is what they've been promised. And at one point, they're like, why did we come? This is worse than Jamaica.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of like just see that, you know, there's a particular, so one of them who wants to become an actress, she gets a job, I think, as a nanny with this sort of white middle class family. And, you know, the dad says, oh, yep, that's basically the one of the kids was asking about, like, you know, saying, oh, she's dark or something like that. And she's like, yep, exactly what we ordered, and told her to stay off the grass. And then was like, no, you go round the back. You don't enter through the front door. And
yeah, that was honestly really unpleasant.
Yeah. Mm. But this is the reality.
And the
bit
with the passport.
Yeah.
It's like levels of racism. You've got your kind of almost casual offhand racism of that white family.
Yeah.
Then you've got really horrible, nasty, disgusting police racism. It's really interesting how it depicts all those different forms of it, if you like, at the same time in different ways. It's fascinating.
I think Lenny Henry with RTD just done a fantastic job.
We should mention the cast. So Rochelle Neal plays Leah, the one sister. Saffron Kumba is her sister Chantrelle, and Yasmin Bilo, who is brilliant as the Christian friend Hosanna. They are all just excellent. I mean, they're absolutely fantastic. And as I say, like I knew them quite quickly and quite instantly. And Javon Prince as well, who plays their brother, who's kind of like a bumbling doofus.
But he feels so much responsibility for him, and it's so sad.
Yeah, it's really sad. Yeah, no, completely. But yeah, it is moving at the same time. Mm.
I was expecting this to be cozy when I went into it. Not just because of the slot, because I thought it was Lenny Henry, that's going to be lovely.
You thought that because it was ITV, James.
It's ITV. Yeah. It's based on Winifred Henry's life. I thought it would be a lovely kind of like slightly nostalgic look at family and whatnot. I was not prepared for quite how hard this actually hits. Like it really does. And the period setting is beautifully done as well. Like it feels incredibly authentic. And, you know, I don't remember the signs in pubs like that, but I do remember how different the view on race was back then. Like not back then, because I wasn't alive when this is there, but like going back even when I was a kid, like going way back then, like it's quite significant. And seeing it, you know, depicted here in the 50s and 60s is brutal, like absolutely brutal, just horrific. And as Boydie says, the fact that these people were invited over to here, like, come here, like, we want you to come. Yeah. And then they got here and were basically abused by people. Okay, well, Three Little Birds then, which airs on the ITV. When, Boydie?
It actually starts on Sunday.
Right. It has aired on the ITV.
Yeah, so we didn't have time for it last week.
Yes.
So we've done it this week.
Yes. How many episodes? How many episodes?
I think it's six.
Three Little Birds, six little episodes.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Excellent. What else is on this week? Well, we should say that Time returns, season two of Time, which has Bella Ramsey in it. It has Jodie Whittaker in it.
Yeah.
And that lands on Sunday on BBC One. And we're going to be reviewing that on this week's Pilot Plus on Thursday.
Yeah.
What We Do in the Shadows returns for its fifth season on Disney Plus. That's on Wednesday. Is there anything else, Boydie?
There is a documentary about Lenny Henry on Thursday on ITV1 at 9 o'clock, which covers his whole career and the build up to the Three Little Birds. It's not a massive week, I have to say. There's a thing called The Lions of Sicily, which is on Disney Plus from Wednesday. They didn't have screeners ready. It's a period Italian drama set between 1800 and 1860. Adapted from a novel, The Florios of Sicily, and it's about brothers and small spice merchants, Paolo and Ignazio, who escaped their backwards-looking region of Calabria to start fresh in Sicily.
I wanted to watch that.
It's got K written all over it. So there's that. I think that might be it. There's Life on Our Planet on Netflix on Wednesday, if you like that kind of thing. Animals.
I like an animal.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't like animals, you want to be avoided.
Yeah, there's a documentary about Milli Vanilli, which will be fascinating. Remember the Milli Vanilli scandal?
You were, I don't remember. I know who Milli Vanilli was, but I don't know what the scandal was.
They didn't sing on their own record.
What?
Yeah, yeah. It was a scandal at the time.
Who sang?
In the 80s. Just session singers, you know.
Wow.
That's terrible.
Yes, it was, yeah, it was a big scandal. And used to was The League of Their Own, James's favourite. It starts Wednesday. The comedy sports panel show that Kay and I both like very much because it's very funny and entertaining, but is absolutely not one for James. There you go.
Pick of the week. What will be our pick of the week?
So,
Fellow Travellers.
Yeah, I love Three Little Birds, but I'm obsessed with Fellow Travellers.
Yeah, FT. Toes.
Toes. Oh, just for the toes.
The toe has it.
Just for the toes. I'm in. I'm sold. That's it for this week's episode of the Pilot TV Podcast. If you enjoyed it, as ever, please do head to Apple Podcasts or the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a 5 sucked toe rating.
Someone mentioned Fiji in one of the reviews I was pleased about.
Did they?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah. Was championing, saying, come on, Fiji, get
bless
on with
them.
It. Yeah.
Come on, Fiji.
Come on, you Fiji. Wow.
Get on board with the podcast.
Yeah. Please do follow us on the social media at James C. Dyer, at Boyd Hilton, at Kay Ribeiro, and at Pilot TV Pod. We'll be back in your ears, as we've said, on Thursday, reviewing Time. We're also going to be dealing with 2 episodes of BoJack Horseman by popular demand.
Oh, yeah.
God help me. So that's going to be fun. And next week, what are we going to be reviewing next week? Who knows? It's Halloween, but that's no horror for Kay. All the Light We Cannot See comes to Netflix next week. Invincible Season 2 comes to Prime. Lawmen Bass Reeves comes to Paramount Plus. And The Gilded Age Season 2 comes to Sky. I don't know if there's anything else. I don't even know if we'll be able to review those. But you have to tune in next week to find out. Until then, Pilot out.